Well, good morning. So those of you who have been watching a lot of football are about to be in going into withdrawals. Now, I'm going to tell you this is my view of the way this works. Okay. Yes, I enjoy football. I've coached football. Football is something that I did, that I played from the time that I was 8. And given all of that, the issue with it is that the reason why I watch it, besides that, is it's still, at this point, it's still one of the few things that you can actually watch and not have to turn your eyes every 15 minutes. Because there are many other things that are on TV that if you're honest, you just don't need to be seeing, because you don't need to have that memory in your head. And that's the truth about much of the programming that's on now. So if you hear that I've fallen asleep in front of football or baseball, I would probably sleep all the way through basketball, no matter what. But it's because there's a certain element of comfort and peace in the fact that I don't have to worry about what I'm going to see. It has been and has always been what I would call what do they call these dramas where they show people in houses getting on each other and living together and doing all this crazy stuff? Reality TV? Well, to me, sports is the original reality TV, because it's real time. It's really happening. There's drama. There's, you know, all the stuff that you would want to see in a dramatic construct. But you at least right now, still, there's an element of, you don't have to worry about everything you see. I know. Yeah. But it's a lot to me. To me, Hallmark is sort of like BBC, in that before the next thing happens, I will have been asleep for a few hours.
That's
fine. It's just they're all sappy. Now, there's some of them that I've liked, and I'll enjoy it every once in a while, you know. Which is why we watch murder mysteries. There you go. Go figure that one out. All that is to say, at times life can be complicated for reasons we don't understand. And that's kind of what Job found himself in. Life got real complicated. He had more on his plate than he could understand. And we're nearing the end of the dialogue, and more of a point of resolution in all of this. Job will get to hear from the true authority very soon, but today we're still dealing with the young buck who has got the Popeye anointing, has stood all he can stand, and he can't stand no more, and has to pop and tell everybody what he thinks. So yes, I guess last week we looked at how he addressed primarily those who were speaking with Job. He transitioned and started talking to Job a bit. Today we're going to look at a chapter that is mostly focused on Elihu addressing Job, and then he starts to kind of defend and talk about God. And there's some things he's got close to being right, and there's some things he still has just not got. And we just need to make sure that we've kind of worked our way through how all this works. But we've got Elihu speaking, and he's primarily speaking at Job in chapter 35. And yes, I'm going to stop, and I'm going to ask you to give me some thoughts as we work our way through this. And it will be a lot more frequent that we stop this Sunday than it was last Sunday. We'll see how far we get. So in chapter 35, I'm looking at NIV. NASB is up on the screen. And, you know, it all is pretty close, but if there's something that we learned from a different version you have a question about, please feel free to ask. So in 35, then it says, "And then Elihu continued and said, 'Do you think this is according to justice?'" Now, in my NIV, it says, "Do you think this is just?" Okay, do you think this is just? And he says, "Do you say My righteousness is more than God's. That's NASB. NIV says, you say, I will be cleared by God. Yet you ask Him, or here in 3 it says, for you say, what advantage will it be to you? What profit will I have more than if I had sinned? Well, in NIV it says, yet you ask Him, talking about Elihu is reflecting what he understands Job to be saying, what profit is it to me, and what do I gain by not sinning? So we've got these three verses. Elihu reflecting back to Job what he believes that Job is saying, the way he perceives what Job is saying. So is Elihu correct in his summary of what Job has been doing and saying? So is Job saying, I will be cleared by God? And is Job saying, what gain is there by not sinning? Or is Elihu somehow mischaracterizing? Let's slow this up. Do you think that Job is saying, God is going to clear me? That God is going to, in some way, vindicate my integrity? Do you think Job is saying that? Has he said that? Okay, that's the first question. We've got to get that one nailed down first. Have you ever perceived, as it says here in the New American Standard, have you ever perceived that Job was saying literally that his righteousness was more righteous than God's? Okay. I have not got that. Okay. That doesn't mean that he's saying that he doesn't that he hasn't done anything to warrant this. Okay. So Elihu could be characterizing it in that Job is saying, because he's done nothing to warrant this, that his viewpoint is more correct than God's. That could be Elihu's version of the facts. Does this make sense? Now, do you think that Job believes that God is going to vindicate him? I think the reality is that Job, one of the reasons that Job is crying out is for that reason. I think he wants God to clear him. He wants God to vindicate him. But for the moment, he's like you and me. Does this make sense? In that we're aching because we want vindication. Does that make sense? I mean, isn't that what you and I would be doing? We would be saying, God, I'm right with you, not because I'm perfect, but because of what you've done, and I need you to defend my reputation. Because I haven't done anything. Does that make sense? Now, Job, has he done that? I think he longs for it. I think he desires it. And I think that's why he's crying out. That's why he, in quote, rails. If you want to say he rails at God, I don't think that that's too far of a reality. Do you? That second thing, what profit is it to me and what do I gain by not sinning? Do you think Job is asking that question? Is Job asking the question, what do I gain by not sinning if this is what happens to me? Is he asking that question? And then the NASB, it's a little bit harder to sort through that, but he is talking about what advantage is it to not do wrong things if you're going to end up like this anyway. So to some degree, Elihu has kind of got it right, and to some degree, we're not sure that he's got it right. Is this accurate? And that's just in the way that he sees what Job is saying. All right, so we push on. Any questions? Any thoughts? Okay. Verse 4, I would like to reply to you and to your friends with you. I will answer you and your friends with you. Okay, I'm going back and forth, NIV and ASB. So I want to get the most out of each version. Okay. So who is it that Elihu's talking to now? He was talking to Job. Who is he talking to now? Okay, now he's talking to the three buddies and to Job. Okay, so he's kind of turns his attention. Okay, all right. And so then in verse 5, he says, look up at the heavens and see. Gaze at the clouds so high above you. Look at the heavens and see. Behold the clouds, they are higher than you. Okay, why would he encourage him to do that? All right, just think about it for a minute. If you sin, how does that affect him? Okay, so if you have sinned, what do you accomplish against him? Okay, so that's an interesting question. What is the answer to Elihu's question? So in the NIV it says, so how does our sin affect God? Essentially, that's the question. Does our sin affect God? If so, how? How about that? How does our sin affect God? Russell gave us an answer. God's our Father. It breaks His heart. Why does it break His heart? Okay, it breaks His heart because He knows what sin does to who? To us. And then us to others. And then our ability to relate to Him. Sin's got all these ramifications that we don't. There are moments where we know and understand how serious sin is. Rarely is it before we do it. Make sense? We may know, but we don't get it until we've done it. Then we realize. We see all those ramifications, all those consequences. Okay, so whenever Elihu asks this question, if you sin, how does that affect him? Does Elihu reflect any kind of real wisdom here? Then the second part of 6, he says there in NASB, and if your transgressions are many, what do you do to him? In other words, does it really matter how much you get in trouble or how many times you sin? What is it? Does it really affect God at all? If this little ant here in the ant pile does something to transgress, so if your sins are many, what does it really do to God? We got to give Elihu at least this credit, though. He is directing Job to a God that they both agree transcends them. And I think in a second you'll see that he at least is trying to speak for the God that they cannot see and control. But he is trying to figure out. He's saying, okay, Job, you're asking this question and you're doing these things, Job. But then he comes back to pointing his finger back at Job, and he's trying to get Job to say something about how sin affects God. And Elihu's default is that our sin doesn't affect God at all. I understand. But his perception is that because God is God and He is that sovereign and He's that holy and He's that over everything, that our sin is so small and we are so insignificant to God that our sin does not affect God any. That's Elihu's. You see that? That's why Elihu's asking these questions. That doesn't make Elihu right. But that is his viewpoint at this juncture. Okay, so he goes on, he says, if you are righteous, that is Job, what do you give to him, or what does he receive from your hand? So up there in 7, says, if you're righteous, what do you give to him, or what does he receive from your hand? In other words, paraphrase that for me. We've got to understand what he's saying. Yeah, okay. Do we have a problem with that? Right. Now, if that is what Elihu would be saying, would we have any problem with that at all? Is God still God? He's still all God, no matter what we do, whether we sin or whether we obey. He's still God, right? Doesn't make him any less powerful or any less God, whether we sin or not. Does this make sense? Why is that important in the world that we live in? I don't seem to feel that at this point that is necessarily what he meant. But even if it were, the sentiment is true. Whether we sin or whether we obey, God is God. It doesn't make him any less God or any less sovereign whether we obey or disobey. Why is that an important thing for us to consider? It's important. It's not, okay, I'm not saying it wasn't important then. I'm just saying I'm trying to apply. Okay, you're right. We're talking about a current day reason why this is important for us. Okay? And the current day reason why I see this being important for us to have thought about and have an answer for is because there are people who want to tie in somehow the reality of who God is to what we do. What you and I, that somehow it's because we think it that makes it so. And that it's not God exists and we exist because He exists. It's that He exists because we exist. Does this make sense? Because there's people, there is a large spectrum of people that say that. That God exists because man exists. Not man exists because God exists. And that is a very important distinction. So we look at the questions here that he's asking about whether he's righteous or whether he's not righteous, or whether God receives anything. Does God get anything from our obedience? Does it make him any more God or any less God the way that we behave? No. God is God. Now, if that's the point that Elihu's making, he's right. Does it matter that we sin or that we obey? Yes. And because Jesus Christ has come, something that Job did not have the benefit of, we know that God has a Father's heart, like Russell was describing. And that though it doesn't do anything to us to make us more a father or mother when we're parents, it still affects us, right? So if Elihu is saying that it doesn't affect God at all, that's not correct. Does this make sense? Yeah. All right, so let's go to 8. So Elihu's still looking at Job, and he says what he says in 8. Your wickedness is for a man like yourself, and your righteousness is for a son of man. That's what he says in New American Standard. In the NIV it says, your wickedness affects only a man like yourself, and your righteousness only the sons of men. So do you understand what he's saying there? Who is it that gets affected by our sin or our obedience, according to Elihu? Us and other people, right? He's saying that we are, it's kind of like there's a dome around the planet, and our sin or our obedience only affects those that are under the dome. Is he correct? Why or why not? I've got my minds going three different directions. I am trying to train my mind so that it does not go off on a tangent. Who does our sin affect? Let's ask that question. Who does sin affect? Yeah. Okay. Okay. What is the proof that it affects God? He sent Jesus. It was enough that God had to, at least he had a plan, and he put the plan that he had from the foundation of the world, as if we believe Scripture, into effect because it does affect God. Doesn't make him less God, but it does affect God. Elihu's looking at it with a one-dimensional lens. Does this make sense? Well, he's just seeing it from the only way he can see it at this point. That's true. Okay, let's look at 9 through 11. He says, men cry out under a load of oppression. They plead for relief from the arm of the powerful. But no one says, where is God my maker, who gives songs in the night, who teaches us more than to teach the beasts of the earth, and makes us wiser than the birds of the air? So when he says, no one says, where is God my maker, is that true? If people are consistent and have been relatively consistent, because I believe, like God said in Psalm, there is nothing new under the sun, I got to believe that there have been people who've been asking this question. Anytime something happens that we don't like in life, that is out of nowhere, that is tragic, is this not what we say? Where is God? Why did this happen? Elihu just stepped into a big pile. Job's been saying it. Absolutely. So it's all of a sudden Elihu, it's almost like, you know how the Eliphaz, Zophar, and Bildad, if they had stopped before they said a thing, we're doing okay. Elihu had made some decent observations, but if he had just shut his mouth now, before he says these things, he at least would have had some good questions. But now he goes and he positions himself right back in the middle of the fracas. So he's saying, nobody says, where's God? It's almost like, where have you been? But then we remember, oh, he's the young buck. Is he really seeing things the way they are? So we'll go on. It says, he does not answer when men cry out because of the arrogance of the wicked. Is he correct in this? God doesn't answer when people cry out. Now, the funny thing is, he just said people don't do this. And now he's saying when people do cry out, he does not answer when men cry out because of the arrogance of the wicked. Is that why God doesn't answer? Question is he right? It's a matter of perception. And that's the lesson I think that God's going to teach Job in just a minute. He's going to clear this up because God's going to speak for himself. So, it's a perception issue on the receiving end, not on the sending end. Going back to good old communication theory. You got a sender, you got a receiver, and there's a message. And what gets in the way of that message between the sender and the receiver, anything that keeps that message from being clear is called static. So is the static on the receiving end or is the static on the sending end? In this case, the static is on the receiving end. We're not perceiving for one way or another, one reason or another. But the way he positions this, and that is, God does not answer when men cry out. We know this to be true or false. Okay? Especially because the wicked are arrogant. So God doesn't does God answer wicked or arrogant people? Yes, he does. Sometimes he spanks them. Sometimes the rain falls on them just like it falls on the good folk, the righteous folk. So Elihu's perception here is clearly skewed. But he's dealing with, again, the system that he understands. God does not communicate with people who are sinning or who have sinned and are still in that sin. He's saying God doesn't do that. Verse 13, indeed, God does not listen to their empty plea. The Almighty pays it no attention. Does God ever ignore anybody who cries out from what we now know, what we understand? He says in 14, how much less then will he listen when you say that you do not see him? So he gives all this to point his finger at Job. And so what is he saying to Job? That'd be verse 14, which is the end of that section. So if all these things, if God does not talk to, does not answer the wicked, okay, which is what he said in 12, and then in 13, it says God does not even listen to the plea of the arrogant, then how much less is he going to listen to you, Job? What did he just say to Job as he was pointing his finger at him? He said, Job, you are what? Okay? Job, he's saying, Job, you are arrogant. Okay? And if you are arrogant, God is not going to answer you. That's why this is the way it is. Is God's not going to answer you whenever you are doing the, where is God? And I'm telling you that nobody ever asked that question, by the way. He's saying nobody ever answered. Job, nobody ever answered. Nobody ever asked that question. God doesn't answer that question that nobody asks. Especially you, because you're arrogant, Job. God isn't even listening. Obviously. Does Elihu know that?
So how much less then will he listen when you say that you do not see him, that your case is before him and you must wait for him? How much less
when you say you do not behold him and the case is before him and you must wait for him. Job, this is empty and worthless because of your condition before God. Do you see it? And now, because he is not visited in his anger, nor has he acknowledged transgression well, so Job opens his mouth emptily. He multiplies words without knowledge. God, he says, does not take the least notice of wickedness. And because of that, what's Job's hope right at this point as far as Elihu is concerned? Does Job have a microwave, have a snowball's chance in a microwave? All right, so tell me a little bit about where Elihu is right now. Has Elihu told Job before this very same thing? Job opens his mouth with empty talk. Without knowledge, he multiplies words. Has he said that before? He said it at least one other time. Now, if somebody repeats something like that, what would that say about the perception of that person? What does Elihu think about Job at this point? What can we tell? Ignorant? Okay. At best, ignorant and misguided. All right, Tim, what you want to say, bud? Yes. And actually, he wants Job to feel guilty. And the funny thing is, when we get next week, when we get to 36, there are some things that, again, Elihu actually somehow stumbles over right and gets right. It's just he's so wrong about some other things. Today, he pretty well tried to, as we look at 35, he is doing his best to bring Job to a point where Job says, I'm a sinner. I did something, and that's why God's not listening to me. So the argument here is not just on, look at the things that have happened to you, you must have sinned. Now Elihu has taken it to the point of, God's not even listening to you or responding to you, therefore you must really be in bad straits with God, because he's not even listening. Okay? Any thoughts? Okie dokie. Brian, why don't you close us in prayer?